This is the podcast for JNS Spine. Hello and welcome. I'm Natalie Pincham, and I'll be reading synopses of some of the articles published by JNS Spine on June 13th, 2014. The topics of the articles featured in this podcast are surgical technique, oncology, the lumbar spine, the thoracic spine, the cervical spine, the sacral spine, congenital malformations, and schwannoma. Safety and efficacy of pedicle screw placement using intraoperative computed tomography. Consecutive series of 1,148 pedicle screws. A clinical article by Mohamed Biden and colleagues. Intraoperative computed tomography scanning has been recently introduced to assist in spinal instrumentation. The objective of this retrospective study was to determine the effectiveness of intraoperative CT scanning in enhancing the safety and accuracy of pedicle screw placement. The authors included all cases from December 2009 to July 2012, in which an intraoperative CT scan was used to confirm pedicle screw placement. Of 1,148 screws placed in 203 patients, approximately 9% of screws were revised intraoperatively in 72 patients. Compared with screws in the thoracic and lumbar regions, pedicle screws placed in the cervical region were statistically significantly more likely to be revised. Two patients required reoperations due to undetected misplacement of pedicle screws. Compared with a similar cohort of patients from the author's institution that had pedicle screws inserted via the freehand technique with postoperative CT, the authors found that the intraoperative CT lowers the threshold for pedicle screw revision, resulting in a statistically significantly higher rate of screw revision in the thoracic and lumbar spine. However, during their 2.5-year experience with intraoperative CT scanning, the authors did not find a reduction in rates of reoperation for misplaced pedicle screws. Outcomes following attempted en bloc resection of cervical chordomas in the C1 and C2 region versus the subaxial region, a multi-institutional experience. A clinical article by Camilo Molina and co-authors. Chordomas are a type of tumor that grows via an indolent course, but can cause significant morbidity and mortality for patients. Previous research has consistently demonstrated that en bloc resection is the ideal treatment for these tumors. For chordomas of the cervical spine and skull base, local invasion of the tumor to the esophagus, vertebral arteries, and other vital structures often complicates resection. The goal of this research was to investigate and compare the clinical outcomes following resection of chordomas occurring at the first and second vertebral levels, C1 and C2, closest to the skull base, to outcomes following resection of tumors of the subaxial spine, that is, the third through seventh cervical vertebral levels. 16 patients were identified from 4 large spine centers. The most common surgical approach for all patients was a staged anterior-posterior approach. En bloc resection was attempted via an anterior approach in only 6% of cases. Attempted en bloc resection of subaxial tumors was significantly more likely to result in margins classified as marginal, as opposed to violated or wide, than resection of axial tumors. Resection of axial tumors resulted in significantly more postoperative complications. The median duration of survival after surgery was not statistically significantly different for patients with axial or subaxial chordomas. Arthroplasty for cervical spondylotic myelopathy. Similar results to patients with only radiculopathy at 3 years follow-up. A clinical article by Li Yu Fei and co-workers. Several prospective randomized FDA trials have demonstrated that cervical arthroplasty is a viable option for one or two-level cervical degenerative disc disease causing radiculopathy or myelopathy. However, there is scant data supporting the use of cervical arthroplasty in patients with cervical spondylotic myelopathy. In this study, the authors analyzed 125 consecutive cases involving patients who underwent one or two-level cervical arthroplasty for cervical degenerative disc disease. A total of 72 patients who had myelopathy were compared with 53 patients who only had radiculopathy. The mean age of the myelopathy group, approximately 53 years, was almost 6 years older than the mean age of the radiculopathy group. 3 years after surgery, both the myelopathy and radiculopathy groups had similar improvement in visual analog scale scores of neck and arm pain, Japanese Orthopedic Association scores, and neck disability index. There were similar rates of heterotopic ossification and mobile discs during follow-up. Neuric scores were significantly improved in patients with cervical spondylotic myelopathy. Overall, the clinical and radiological outcomes were equally good for patients with cervical spondylotic myelopathy than those patients who only had radiculopathy. The authors concluded that cervical arthroplasty represents a potential option for patients with cervical spondylotic myelopathy who needed anterior cervical discectomy. En bloc hemisacrectomy and internal hemipelvectomy via the posterior approach. A technical note by Michelle Clark and colleagues. Traditionally, hemisacrectomy and internal hemipelvectomy procedures for en bloc resection of sacropelvic lesions have required both an anterior and a posterior approach. These relatively morbid procedures are complicated by the need to perform complex spinal column and pelvic ring reconstruction, which is mandated whenever the S1 body is iatrogenically disrupted. In this paper, the authors describe three novel cases in which an en bloc resection of the hemisacrum and ilium and subsequent lumbopelvic and pelvic ring reconstruction were performed from a posterior-only approach. A more traditional approach via anterior and posterior staged procedures is described in two cases for comparison. The impact of a single-stage approach on overall morbidity, the ability to achieve an oncological resection, and potential complications such as iliac vessel injury are discussed as well. In vivo, 3D kinematic changes in the cervical spine after laminoplasty for cervical spondylotic myelopathy. A clinical article by Yukitaka Nagamoto and co-workers. Although restriction of neck motion is a well-known complication of cervical laminoplasty, 3D postoperative cervical motion has not been previously reported. In this study, the authors clarify the 3D kinematic changes in the cervical spine of patients treated with cervical laminoplasty. Preoperatively and at 6 months after laminoplasty, 11 patients underwent CT of the cervical spine in neutral position, with head rotation of 45 degrees to the left and to the right, as well as in maximum flexion and maximum extension. Segmental range of motion was calculated both in flexion extension and in rotation. The mean flexion extension range of motion for C2 through C7, equivalent to cervical range of motion in previous studies, showed a statistically significant 33% decrease. However, the mean flexion and extension motion for the occiput through T1 showed an insignificant 7% decrease. When the authors evaluated range of motion at each individual motion segment, they found a statistically significant 22.6% decrease in the mean segmental range of motion at the operated levels during flexion extension and a statistically insignificant 10.2% decrease during rotation. On the other hand, a statistically insignificant 37.2% increase was observed at the upper cervical spine during flexion extension. In this study, the occiput through T1 range of motion, which represented total cervical range of motion, did not change significantly 6 months after laminoplasty, despite a significant decrease in C2-7 flexion extension range of motion. The authors believe that this is partially due to a compensatory increase in segmental range of motion at the upper cervical spine. Primary malignant peripheral nerve sheath tumor of the spine with acute hydrocephalus, a rare clinical entity. A case report by Yazhong Li and colleagues. Primary malignant peripheral nerve sheath tumors, or MPNSTs, are extremely rare in patients without a history of neurofibromatosis. In this paper, the authors report their experience with one new case. A 33-year-old woman presented with low back pain radiating to the right calf that progressed over 1 year. Magnetic resonance imaging of the spine revealed an intradural extramedullary lesion at the T12 to L1 level. The patient was diagnosed with primary MPNST. She underwent 2 surgical excisions and radiation therapy and developed leptomeningeal metastases as well as brain metastases. A subsequent brain CT scan displayed bilateral lateral ventricle enlargement, for which a ventriculoperitoneal shunt was inserted. In this case, the tumor had disseminated to all spinal segments and the brain, with a communicating hydrocephalus, which is the first such case reported. There is no definite consensus regarding treatment of primary intradural MPNSTs. The optimal management of these tumors largely depends on the personal experience of the treating medical team. The overall prognosis is very poor. More research is expected in the future to improve the prognosis of this disease. Isolated central canal rupture of spinal dermoid. A report of 3 cases by Kanwaljeet Garg and Rajinder Kumar. Spinal dermoid tumors are rare, benign, slow-growing tumors. Unlike rupture of cranial dermoids, rupture of spinal dermoids has been only rarely reported, and isolated rupture into the central canal is even more rare, with only a few cases reported in the literature. The authors report 3 cases of isolated rupture of a spinal dermoid into the central canal and review the previously reported cases. They note that magnetic resonance imaging is the investigation of choice to diagnose these lesions and determine the extent of distribution of ruptured content into the central canal and subarachnoid space. The preferred treatment is surgical excision of the primary lesion, followed by close observation. The authors note that no treatment is required for the fat droplets in the central canal. Cauda equina schwannoma presenting with intratumoral hemorrhage and intracranial subarachnoid hemorrhage. A case report by Sunil Kukreja and co-authors. The authors describe an unusual case of cauda equina schwannoma. Along with the typical clinical features of spinal cord tumors, this patient demonstrated subarachnoid hemorrhage on a CT study that was performed given the patient's history of seizure episodes in the recent past. Cerebral angiography failed to show any intracranial source for the subarachnoid hemorrhage. However, magnetic resonance imaging revealed two lesions in the lower spinal segment, one of which arose from the cauda equina and another just proximal to it. The lesion in the cauda equina had typical signal changes that indicated bleeding within the tumor. Intratumoral hemorrhage and subarachnoid hemorrhage in one patient has not yet been reported in the literature. This case also supports the mechanical theory, which has been proposed to understand the mechanism of hemorrhagic events in spinal tumors arising from the cauda equina. It probably explains why hemorrhagic changes were observed only in the lesion situated in the cauda equina and not in the lesion lying proximal to it. Thank you for listening. JNSPG podcast content is now contained in the American Association of Neurological Surgeons iTunes U site. Sign up in iTunes for our podcasts and additional content, including video content and podcasts from the AANS, all updated continuously. Comments on this podcast can be sent to jnspodcast@thejns.org.